Nightlife Science.
And joining us for a look this week at science and scientific matters, only the Charlie Limeweaver can answer. Charlie, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Good evening, you encephalated biped.
I know, trying to stay as cephalated as I can. What about this new study of quasars? I've got to remind myself what a quasar is in a moment. That finds that the cosmic dawn ended 200 million years later than cosmologists thought.
Now, isn't this news about something that you never knew was could be news? So to answer your question, quasars, what are quasars? Quasars are the brightest things that people with optical telescopes can see. These are supermassive black holes that are just gorging themselves on stars and material around them. They're swallowing all kinds of things, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. That's what a quasar is. So a supermassive black hole that's being fed. And these are the brightest objects in the sky. It's kind of like they're at the center of galaxies, and you can't see the rest of the galaxy. All you can see is the center engorging of the black hole in the middle. So that's what a quasar is.
Mm-hmm.
So these are so bright that you can see them further away than any other type of object. So that's why they're useful as, probes of the early universe, because we can see them when they're so far away. So this new study looked at 67 quasars, and they, by looking at their spectra, they could tell when the universe changed from being neutral hydrogen to ionized hydrogen. And that's the cosmic dawn. It's called the reionization of the universe, when the neutral hydrogen with a proton electron just got broken apart by high energy radiation, mm-hmm. and the proton went off and the electron went off. And that's called the reionization of the universe. And that's the kind of universe we live in now. The hydrogen has been reionized all over the universe. And the cosmic dawn is when that reionization happened.
All right.
Does that make any sense?
Well, kind of. Well, so the cosmic dawn is like real life. That's when the world as we know it, Charlie.
Well, not really. Here's the simple version. Mm-hmm. You start out with a big, hot universe that's really, really hot, yeah. and therefore it's all ionized, right? And then it cools down, expands and cools, and then it becomes neutral. The electrons and protons come together, form neutral hydrogen. That's the period of the cosmic microwave background radiation. That's what I did my PhD on. We looked at the hot spots and the cool spots in that radiation. That's at 380,000 years after the Big Bang. So that's not even 500,000 years after the Big Bang.
Okay.
So that's when the universe became neutral. But then gradually, as things clumped, stars started to form, and these were very big stars, and then quasars started to form. These big things put out energetic photons, and they ripped apart the electrons and the protons and reionized the universe, and that's the dawn when the universe became bright and reionized itself. And the real research here is that this period happened 200 million years after we thought it did.
Okay.
So instead of 0.9 billion years after the Big Bang, they find a date of 1.1 billion years after the
okay.
Big Bang.
Now, I'm very excited about this new one. What about this? A new company called Spin Launch. Now we're talking.
Now we're talking something you'll understand more easily.
A new company, Spin Launch, hurls things into space with a centrifuge. Now, when I was a little kid, I always thought if you spun the merry-go-round fast enough, you'd go somewhere fast. And so,
or Goliath. Think of David with the sling, right? He's
boom, yeah. And I was thinking of the ancient medieval catapult. Although that's not really a centrifuge; that's just a lever, isn't it? So,
right.
So hang on. You can't throw something into space, can you?
Well, that's what most people thought until this spin launch company said, hey, maybe you can. And apparently they're making some progress.
Yeah.
A lot of people think, oh, that's a crazy idea. But here's the idea, basically. Right now they have a 30% scale model in the desert in New Mexico. And it's the 30% is 10 meters in diameter. And they're sending rockets that are about 3 meters long up as high as they can get. Yeah. Right now, they did a recent test. They sent something up about 8 kilometers. So how this works is it's a centrifuge. It's like a big disc, bigger than the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
And it's evacuated so they can spin a rocket really, 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 really fast. And then they let go. It breaks through a plastic barrier because the whole thing is evacuated. They have to be evacuated because they're going so fast they can't have friction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the whole thing is operated by electricity. It's kind of like doing what the Large Hadron Collider does with protons, but here they're doing the same thing.
But presumably, doesn't the rocket just fall apart?
No. That's why you do have to build really strong material, like carbon nanotubes and the strongest material they can think of. It has, I'm not sure how many Gs, but it's like 10,000. A human being could never survive on this, and most materials would never survive the amount of acceleration.
Mm.
But you construct rockets that are specifically made to withstand the amount of Gs, the amount of acceleration, and then you launch them. It's kind of cool. Matter of fact, if you go on YouTube, you can see one of the launches that they did a few months ago.
Okay.
And apparently, they're making enough progress and they have enough supporters that they're not only going to go 8 kilometers, maybe next time they're going to go, I don't know, 20 kilometers or
so. How far is space? It's 15 or 20. Oh, is it 15?
Well,
no, 20 kilometers.
That's how long is a piece of string. It depends. You know, when you're flying across the Pacific, you're flying at 30,000 feet or about 10, 11, 12 kilometers. That's where there's still air. Above that, the air starts to get very thin. You get sounding balloons go up to about 40 kilometers, so there's still enough air to support the balloons. You get about 400 kilometers is where the International Space Station is.
Okay.
So you could say space starts at 400 kilometers, and so that's what they're doing.
So the centrifuge has got a bit of a way to go then, actually.
It does. It does. On the other hand, you could think, well, wait a minute, why don't they put a little rocket juice into this rocket fuel into these rockets that they're launching? And then when it gets up to, I don't know, 20 kilometers, they turn that on. And maybe that's what's another option they're doing.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a real cool thing. It's in New Mexico, and it's interestingly weird, and it seems to be working to the surprise of many people.
Yeah.
And I recommend going online and look at the YouTube of that.
Spin launch, it's called. Okay, and speaking of launches, NASA will launch from New Zealand a small satellite to test the unusual future orbit of a lunar space station. Are they going to build a lunar space? I thought they're going to build a station on the moon, not around the moon.
Oh, the answer to that question is both.
Right.
So you remember, I don't know if you remember the Apollo missions to the moon, and they sent three astronauts. One of them, Michael Collins, stayed in the lunar module, which was in orbit around the moon.
He did.
And then Aldrin and Armstrong took the lunar lander, went down, and then they came back to the lunar module, and then they flew back to the Earth. Right.
He was the loneliest man in the universe at that point.
That's right. So what they're proposing now is to have a lunar module, or essentially a small space station, kind of like the International Space Station, but a much smaller version that's going to be in orbit around the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to act as a, you know, hey, I want to go to the moon. Okay, you send astronauts to this little space station. They then get there kind of, I don't know, to have a lunch break. And then they get into a lunar module, go down to the surface, do what they want to do, or maybe start this colony. Then they come back to the module, do whatever they want to do, and then they can stay there for a while or then go back to Earth. So the whole point is it's a miniature space station that you can inhabit for a while, and it will act as a relay station between the lunar surface and the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the idea. It's called the Gateway module.
Okay. Okay.
And the test will be launched in the next, I don't know, week or two, from the Mahia Peninsula. That's on the eastern side of the North Island of New Zealand. And it's by a company, the company is called Rocket Lab. And they have this is a rocket company that's specializing not in launching big things like SpaceX, but in launching things like the size of a shoebox or the size of at the very largest, I don't know, maybe a person or something.
Okay.
That kind of people. But they're going to launch CubeSats. This is a very quickly increasing market for very small satellites, and that's the niche that they're hoping to.
Yeah. Mind you, people in space, we used to say men in space, didn't we? But, I mean, we don't say that anymore. But people in space will, I mean, the whole market for this is hotting up, isn't it? Because the voyage to the moon is not that far away. I understand.
Well, no, it's called the NASA Artemis program, and they're scheduled for 2025 to land on the moon and start this whole procedure.
Yeah.
But before you do this, they have this the reason they're sending this proto satellite up to test the orbit is because the orbit is really, really strange. It gets as close to the moon as 1,600 kilometers and as far away as 70,000 kilometers. So it's really, really eccentric. I'm not sure why they chose such an eccentric orbit, but to test the stability and how much energy they need to keep something in that weird orbit, they're sending this new small thing up in a week or two.
Yeah, interesting. All right, now, as if we needed this, there are apparently thousands of previously undescribed viruses in the ocean. Dear, oh dear. Really?
Well, no, I think you are giving viruses a bad name. I think if you eliminated viruses from the planet...
Right now, Charlie, if you walked into a bar and said, I'm a virus, I'm sorry, it would be a room-clearing thing.
No, you're right, but I'm a scientist, and there's not many scientists in that bar. Scientists are looking at the viruses and seeing all the good and the bad things that the viruses do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's like bacteria. You know, when first people found out about bacteria, they said, oh, that's terrible, terrible, terrible. But then they said, wait a minute, there's some good bacteria too. And my money, smart money, is on the idea that I think there are more good bacteria than bad bacteria.
Yeah. Are they good viruses?
Yes, of course.
I know about good bacteria. I never think of good viruses. Really?
That's not my fault, Phil. That's your fault. So here.
Hang on. Give me an example of a good virus.
Well, that's the whole point. We don't know much about viruses at all. We haven't figured this out. But this new study, there's a little bit of detail here, but let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So they did there's a boat called Tara. They went around the world to the Arctic, to the tropics, to the temperate zones, and collected water. Now, about a few years ago, they studied the DNA viruses in the water, and they published the results. But a lot of viruses are RNA viruses. You know the difference between RNA and DNA?
Yeah.
You know, DNA has a thymine, and if you substitute for one of the nucleotides, you get uracil in RNA. Anyway, RNA, we think, was even more fundamental, more basic, earlier than DNA. Anyway, viruses have both DNA and RNA viruses. And so he analyzed this group analyzed the DNA viruses. Now they said, well, wait a minute, let's refine our techniques. It's really hard, but we'll get the analysis right so we can look at the RNA viruses. They managed to do that. They found 5,000 unknown RNA viruses. And here's the part that you asked about good viruses.
Hmm.
Apparently, these viruses, well, they infect plankton, and plankton is like the base of the food web in the ocean, and they control some of the lifestyle. They can make a plankton go dead, but they can also modify the metabolism of the plankton to make them more efficient at doing whatever they do. So it seems to be the case, and they have evidence for this, that the RNA viruses are also involved in making these plankton more efficient at doing what they do.
Okay.
So, some people think, look at your DNA. The human DNA is like 5% viral. I think the answer to that question is the human genome, and like all other genomes, is 100% viral, in the sense that DNA is, well, viruses just go in and out and in and out and have for the past 4 billion years of the genomes of more established critters like you and me and amoeba and bacteria. So viruses have an incredibly unknown but very important role to play in the origin of life and even life today. So thing about this is that biologists don't even know that viruses are alive. They think, oh, maybe they're alive, maybe they're not. So that's an interesting frontier of what is life question. I think we don't know what life is precisely because we don't know, we can't decide on whether viruses are alive. So for me, the whole viral world, virology is a very important part of astrobiology and finding about the origin of life.
Yeah. I'm going to invite a few viruses back home.
Believe me, you already have. The whole weird thing is about you only find out about viruses when they do something bad. And for the rest of the time, we just ignore them complacently. And it's just silly. I'm guarantee you that there are more good viruses than there are bad viruses.
and Charlie said it first.
That's right.
All right, Charlie. Good on you.
All right. Good night.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.